This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com. This is the Relic Radio Show. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining me again this week. We've got an interesting show for you. As always, we have two episodes of old-time radio. We're going to start off with Cabin B-13 from Suspense, an episode that aired March 16th, 1943. Then it's a quick Incredible But True in the Room Upstairs. We'll finish off with the series Cabin B-13 that was spun off from that episode of Suspense. The episode we're going to hear from Cabin B-13, The Sleep of Death, first aired December 26th, 1948.
Suspense. This is the Man in Black, here to introduce Columbia's program, Suspense. In Hollywood this evening, our two distinguished stars are the lovely actress Margot and the polished young actor from Holland, Mr. Philip Dorn. A story by John Dixon Carr dealing with strange, very strange happenings aboard an ocean liner and called Cabin B-13 is tonight's tale of suspense. If you have been with us before, you will know that suspense is compounded of mystery and suspicion and dangerous adventure. In this series are tales calculated to intrigue you, to stir your nerves, to offer you a precarious situation and then withhold the solution until the last possible moment. And so with Cabin B-13, and with the performances of Margot as Ann Brewster and Philip Dorn as Dr. Carl Heinrich, we again hope to keep you in suspense. Come now, in happier peacetime days, to a great ocean liner on the night of her departure for Europe. There she is at the West 22nd Street Pier, the 25,000-ton Moravania of the White Planet Line. Smoke from her three funnels coils up lazily in mild October air. You can see the decks, white and shiny like shoeboxes, and the string of lights along them, and the band standing by on A-deck to play her out. You can hear the murmur of an excited crowd and the rattle of the steam winches as cargo is lowered into the hold. You can see the bustle of activity and the second officer standing at the head of the gangplank as two rather late passengers hurry through the customs shed towards that gangplank.
It's all right, Ricky. We are not too late.
No, and I thought we'd be in time.
A honeymoon in Europe. 3 whole months with nothing to worry about.
That's right, dear. And you've been my wife for, let's see, practically 5 hours now.
I believe the correct phrase is, it was so sudden, Mr. Brewster.
So sudden that we have to travel on our own passports instead of a husband and wife one. I hope they don't think you're not an honest woman.
I'm going to act like a complete wanton just to devil you. Oh, what about our tickets, Ricky? Do we give them to that officer standing at the top of the gangplank?
No, honey, you keep your ticket. The cabin steward will come around and collect it after we're underway.
And the money, Ricky?
It's a lot of money, Anne. $10,000 in cash. Maybe I better turn it in at the purser's office for safekeeping.
Yes, maybe you had. Wait a minute, Ricky.
What is it, dear?
Wait. Do you mind if we stand here for a second before we go up the gangplank?
Well, what's the matter? You're not ill, are you?
No, but getting over brain fever isn't any joke.
Oh, I know, dear.
You see, Ricky, I ought to be eager and excited like all those people up there, but suddenly you get fancies. Queer, sick fancies. Suddenly, right now, all I can think of is the night and the wind and all the black water in the dark.
And that's exactly the kind of morbid fancy I'm trying to cure you of.
I know, Ricky. I'll be good, but I was just thinking of a story.
What story?
Oh, never mind. It doesn't matter. Which way do we go?
Up the gangplank, through that door there, and then down on the elevator to B deck. And no more horrors, do you understand? B deck and cabin number. Good Lord. B-13.
B-13.
You're not superstitious, are you?
Why, no, dear. Not about things like that. Open the door.
Here we are. Lights on and...
Oh, Ricky, darling. It's a beautiful cabin.
Best I could get. Well, they've got a luggage in anyway. And over there, madam, you'll find a basket of fruit and some books from your obedient servant.
Oh, you are nice to me. And I'm feeling so much better, Ricky. I will be all right, darling.
Of course you will. But you won't find any detective novels among those books.
Please. Please, Ricky.
Detective novels may be all right for presidents and college professors, but they're straight poison to you. You'll read love stories and like it.
You know, Ricky, I keep thinking and thinking about that story I mentioned.
Now, what story, dear?
It's an old one. You probably know it, but it was new to me. A woman and her daughter arrive in Paris and go to a hotel.
Oh, you mean the old Paris exposition story?
Yes, that's it. The daughter goes out. When she returns, her mother has disappeared. And even the hotel room isn't the same. The proprietor of the hotel swears the girl came there alone and that there never was a mother. The whole room is different when she goes back to look at it. The girl goes to the police and they won't believe her and she's nearly crazy. Of course, it turns out that the mother has caught bubonic plague and died, and they're hushing it up so that the visitors won't keep away from the city and ruin the whole exposition,
Anne,
but...
you've got to stop this kind of talk.
I know. But imagine being in a situation like that, with all those queer eyes staring at you, wondering if you'd lost your reason, wondering if your brain had cracked and the whole world might dissolve and... Listen.
Well, that's the last call, Anne. We'll be underway any minute now.
You know, Ricky, I would like to see the skyline go past and the Statue of Liberty and the rest of it.
Well, then why not go up and see it? I've got to deposit this money in the purser's office on C-Deck.
But I don't like you to leave me.
Oh, now look here, dear. You don't think I'm going to disappear, do you?
I suppose I don't really. When I get these ideas, and I can't help it, Ricky, I wish you'd wallop me.
I'm not going to wallop you, Anne, but you've got to stop being afraid. You certainly won't disappear in a crowded ship with any number of people all around you. As for me, I defy Houdini himself to make me vanish.
Don't talk like that.
I'm not going to vanish, and neither is this cabin, dear. Now, run along. I'll join you on deck as soon as I can.
All right, Ricky. I'll be good. Eager people, excited people, happy people, all crowding up to the rail to wave goodbye. Nothing to worry about, nothing on their minds except...
Except what?
Oh.
Except seasickness, madam?
Oh.
Well, I beg your pardon. I hadn't meant to startle you, believe me.
Please don't mention it, how silly of me. It was my fault. I haven't been very well.
I noticed it, madam, if you'll forgive me. That was why I spoke to you. As you see by my uniform, I'm the ship's doctor.
This is a British ship, isn't it? But you don't sound British.
No, I'm an Austrian, madam. Dr. Paul Heinrich, at your service. I'm not very popular in my own country today. The days of colored shirts and vacant minds.
I'm Mrs. Brewster, doctor. Anne Brewster. When does the ship go?
In about a second, Mrs. Brewster. You will hear the whistle, then the band will strike up, all lang syne, and then...
Aren't we?
Yes. Oh, don't you feel the vibration of the engine?
What time does the bar open aboard this time, huh?
I imagine this is not your first crossing, madam.
Oh, I'm afraid it is, Dr. Heinrich. My husband's crossed many times, he tells me, but not on this ship.
Well, then I hope you're a good sailor.
Why, Dr. Heinrich?
Well, because we'll run into some very dirty weather once we're out at sea. October is a very bad month for traveling.
Well, if I do get seasick, Doctor, I'll rush straight to you, and I'll expect to be cured.
Let me tell you a secret, madam. There are two common ailments for which medical science has no cure. One is ordinary seasickness, and the other is hangover. Tomorrow morning I shall be dealing with both.
And enjoying it?
Oh, no. Sympathizing with it. That's all I can do. How do you like the Mauravania?
Oh, it's a magnificent ship from what I've seen of it. And you know they've given us a very nice cabin down on B deck, B-13. What's the matter? Why are you looking at me like that?
I beg your pardon. Did you say B-13?
Yes. Why not?
You're quite sure of that, madam?
Why, yes, of course I'm sure of it. I saw the number on the door. Why not?
Well, because...
Go on, Dr. Heinrich.
Because there's no such cabin aboard a ship. I'm not joking, Mrs. Brewster. You see, some people are superstitious. Many ships, like this one, omit number 13 on each deck. You must have been mistaken.
What are you trying to tell me? Do you think I saw something that wasn't there?
No, Mrs. Brewster, not at all.
Then come along with me. I'll show you. I'll prove to you that there is a number 13. Will you come along?
Yes, Mrs. Brewster. I think perhaps I had better escort you.
Stewardess!
Yes, miss. Yes, ma'am. Come in straight away.
Tell me, stewardess, this is B deck, isn't it?
B deck, ma'am? Oh, yes, ma'am. No doubt about that.
Dr. Heinrich and I have been all over this part of the ship looking for cabin number 13, but we don't...
I've been trying to convince this lady stewardess that there's no such cabin, cabin number 13 on this ship.
Why, there sure to heaven isn't, ma'am. And never has been. I've served aboard the Mauravania a matter of 8 years, and I ought to know.
But I tell you, I saw it. I was in there. It was a big cabin with a private bathroom attached. The walls were paneled in light oak, and the furniture was rosewood and yellow satin, and the portholes were like real windows.
No, that's not much good, ma'am.
No, I'm afraid not. Most of the cabins hereabouts look like that. May I ask you, what name was the cabin booked in?
Brewster, naturally. Mr. and Mrs. Richard E. Brewster.
Here, let's have a look on my list. No. No, there's no Brewster here, ma'am.
I tell you, I was in there. They even delivered the luggage. I saw it.
Excuse me, ma'am. But I had a look-see in all the cabins I'm in charge of, just to see if the passengers wanted anything. And I don't remember any luggage with a Brewster label on it.
Wait a minute. There may be a partial explanation of this.
You see, that's better, Mrs. Brewster. I was hoping you might find one.
Ricky, that's my husband. Ricky and I have only been married a very short time, and... when my maid printed the baggage label, she must have made them out in my maiden name. I never noticed at the time.
Oh, what name might that be, ma'am?
Thornton. Anne Marie Thornton.
Oh, Lord, miss. Now, why couldn't you have said that before? I remember it well. Two silk cases and a little trunk. They're in B-16 now.
Where's B-16?
Right behind you, miss. You're standing practically in front of the door.
Oh, thank goodness. Oh, yes, but, what about my husband's luggage?
There's no gentleman's luggage in that cabin, miss. Your husband's or any other gentleman's, if you know what I mean.
I won't stand for this. Where's Ricky? What have you done with Ricky?
Please, Mrs. Brewster. There's one easy way to settle this.
Settle it? How?
Just look down the corridor. You notice the man coming towards us? The man with the two gold stripes around his sleeve?
Well?
That's Mr. Marshall, our second officer. Did you ever see him before?
Yes. Yes, of course I have. He was standing at the top of the gangplank when Rick and I got aboard.
Exactly. So he might be able to tell us something.
Oh.
Mr. Marshall? Mr. Marshall?
Yes, Doctor, what's up?
Would you mind coming here for a moment?
Well, not at all, old boy. Always glad to oblige a chap who may have to cut me up at any moment, eh? What may I do for you?
Take a good look at this young lady. And tell me, have you seen her before?
Seen her before? My dear chap, if I had overlooked, young lady will pardon me, I know, a passenger as charming as this lady is, I would be less of the gentleman than I fancy myself. Eh?
You saw her coming aboard tonight?
Oh, yes, certainly.
And, of course, you saw the gentleman who was with her.
The gentleman who was with her?
Yes.
Oh, But there was nobody with her, old boy.
You're quite certain of that, Mr. Marshall?
Well, my dear doctor, she was the last of them to come aboard. I'll take my Bible oath there was no other passenger with her, or ahead of her, or behind her, if it comes to that.
You're lying to me.
Please, well, please, Mrs. Brewster, lower your voice.
I know what it is. It's the old Paris trick, like in the story. But you won't get away with it, do you hear?
Now, look here, madam.
I'll go to the purser, I'll go to the captain. Oh, dear Father in heaven, won't anybody believe me?
Later that night, in the captain's room just abaft the bridge, there is a conference of ship's officers. Outside, stung by spray, clinging to the bulkhead rail in the dark, a frightened girl waits until the door of the cabin's room opens.
Can you bring the young lady in, Dr. Heinrich? Close the door.
Yes, sir. Here we are. This is Captain Wainwright. Now, just tell your story straightforwardly and... Please, don't excite yourself.
Well, maybe we can get some decision into this matter. Will you sit down here beside my desk, Miss Thornton?
My name is Brewster, Captain. Mrs. Anne Brewster.
Whatever you say, Mrs. Brewster.
Thank you very much, Captain.
I might tell you, ma'am, I've got a lot on my mind already. The first officer comes aboard with an attack of flu. I'm facing an equinoctial gale short-handed, and now this has to happen on top of it.
I'm terribly sorry. I can't help that, Captain. But I want to know what they've done with Ricky.
Just one moment, please, while I get this straight. By this time, I understand, you yourself have personally interviewed practically every single passenger aboard this ship. Is that true?
Yes, it's true.
But your alleged husband is not here. Is that true?
Yes, that's true,
In the meantime, the purser has sent a squad of men to search this ship. They've searched every inch of it. You can take my word for that. There's nobody hidden. Your husband's not here. According to Mr. Marshall, who's standing over there...
I see him.
According to Mr. Marshall, he never was here.
Oh, hang it all, Miss Thornton. You needn't glare at me like that. We couldn't see the chap. He wasn't there, now could we?
Be quiet, Mr. Marshall.
Yes, I'm sorry.
No, I'm not unreasonable, Mrs. Brewster. I think you'll admit that. But what can I do? What can I say... Can you offer any proof, even, that this husband of yours ever existed?
Proof? Yes, of course I can.
Excuse me for interrupting, but would you mind, Captain, if I ask a question or two?
No, Doctor, go ahead. I tell you, I'm going daft myself.
If you were married, Mrs. Brewster, you must be carrying a joint husband and wife passport. Where is that?
Well, there wasn't time to get one. We each carried our own passport.
Oh, I see. But still, there must be someone back in America who can confirm what you say if we got in touch by radio telephone. Your parents, for instance.
I haven't got any parents. They're dead.
What about relatives, then, or a guardian?
My guardian is a trust company. The administrators don't even know I'm married.
But somebody must have performed the ceremony of marriage. The parson, the justice of peace.
Yes, of course, of course. But, oh, I can't remember the name of the town.
You don't remember the name of the town?
Well, tie to your chair, Mrs. Brewster. The ship is going to pitch again.
How's the glass looking, Mr. Marshall?
Barometer's rising, sir. This weather won't hold long. We shall be in the fog before morning, huh?
We're in a fog now, if you ask me. This lady says she...
terribly sorry, but I'm trying to think of it. It was a little town in upstate New York where they can marry you at a moment's notice. Ricky kept the certificate. I was confused. I haven't been well.
No, you haven't.
You see, Ricky had been away, and he came back, and I was in love with him, and he sort of swept me off my feet, and... Oh, what's the use?
Not much use, apparently.
If you'll take my advice, ma'am, you'll go below to your cabin and get some sleep. I'll send the doctor down to mix you a sedative.
You think I'm crazy, don't you?
I think you're a little overwrought, ma'am.
What I can't understand is why. Why should you want to do this? It can't be the bubonic plague this time.
Bubonic plague, ma'am? Who said anything about the bubonic plague?
Never mind. But I'll show you. You're all against me, except maybe the doctor. But I'll show you. I'll prove it to you. I am going downstairs, and I don't want anybody to follow me. Good night. Good night, all of you.
Well, I'm glad that's over.
Look here, Mr. Marshall.
Huh?
You think it's quite safe to trust her out there alone?
Well, I don't know, sir. She's mad as a hatter, if you ask me.
You think she might do something foolish?
Well, I think she might chuck herself overboard if we're not careful.
What's your opinion, Doctor?
I can give you my opinion, gentlemen, in a very few words. That girl is as sane as you are.
What's that?
Wait and hear what I have to say. I shared your own belief at first, but I've been talking to her all evening. I've heard her whole story, and there's not a psychopathic trait in her nature. She firmly believes in this husband.
Yes, Doctor. A lot of people firmly believe they're Napoleon, but they get tossed into loony bins, that's the same.
This matter is not a joke, Mr. Marshall. I tell you, this man exists, or did exist.
What do you mean, Doctor?
I suppose he has been murdered. Perhaps he has been murdered and thrown overboard.
Murdered? Thrown overboard?
If you remember, Richard Brewster was carrying a very large sum of money in cash. His wife's wedding gifts. Practically all her inheritance. He meant to go to the purser's office. But he never got there. That money might have been a great temptation.
To whom?
To a stewardess, perhaps, or even to a ship's officer.
Just exactly what are you getting at?
Well, numbers on doors can be changed easily enough. Just print a small card and put it on the metal slot on the door.
I still want to know what you're driving at.
If you use your intelligence, gentlemen, I think you will understand how a man can be made to vanish into thin air. And why Mr. Marshall saw never another passenger. You still don't see it?
No, I do not.
Well, then listen. And I'll explain exactly how it was created.
O'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock. The hour of suicides and bad dreams. The gale has subsided. The sea is calm. The SS Mauravania creeps blindly at barely 8 knots through a thick and strangling fog. The whole ship is dark and sealed up in sleep. There's no sound in all that mournful dimness, except when the foghorn cries out a warning overhead. Even cabin B-16 is dark. And Brewster, still fully dressed, lies restlessly across one of the berths, her head almost touching the intercabin telephone.
What was... Oh, I thought I heard... Telephone. Yes? Hello?
It's me, Anne. Take it easy now.
Ricky! Ricky, where are you?
Quiet. Keep your voice down.
Where are you, Ricky? What happened to you? Are you hurt?
No, I'm not hurt, but he nearly got me.
Who nearly got you?
Listen, dear. I can't explain over the phone, and I don't dare go down there. Can you meet me up on deck?
Yes, of course. Where?
Do you know the boat deck?
Boat deck? Which one is that?
The top deck, where all the lifeboats are slung.
Oh, yes, I know it.
Well, go to the starboard side.
Yes?
That's the right-hand side, facing forward. Find the fourth lifeboat from the aft companionway.
Yes.
There's a thick fog, and nobody will see us.
Ricky, what is it? Ricky! He's gone. He's gone.
Excuse me, miss, but I thought I heard somebody talking in here.
Stewardess, what are you doing up at this time of the night?
If I might ask, miss, what are you doing up and dressed? Oh, you ought to get some sleep, miss. You really ought.
It might interest you to know, stewardess, that I've just been talking to my husband.
Now, look here, miss. Don't start that all over again. Please, don't start that all over again.
You all pretended to think I was mad, didn't you? And you nearly drove me mad. Ricky's beaten the whole crowd of you, and I'm going out on deck to meet him now.
Out on deck, miss?
That's what I said. Where's my coat?
Don't go out there, miss. Not in the state of mind you're in. And the fog's so thick, you can't hardly see your hand in front of your face.
Stand away from the door, please.
Suppose, miss... I didn't want to let you go out there.
I don't think that would matter much. You've probably heard that mad people have 10 times ordinary strength, and I'm stronger than you anyway.
Miss, I'm a-begging you.
Stand away from that door. Third.
Anne, is that you?
Yes. Ricky. Ricky, darling, where are you?
Here, duck your head under the lifeboat. You take my hand.
But isn't it horribly dangerous out there on the edge? There's no railing along the side of the ship.
Don't worry, Anne. I won't let you fall.
Look out!
Oh, went overboard here. We're well aft near the propellers. The suction would carry into the propeller blades. And listen.
I can't hear anything except the foghorn.
Yeah, but I can. There's somebody walking along the deck. And I can see a flashlight moving in the fog.
You're quite right, my friend. You can see a flashlight moving in the fog.
Dr. Heinrich, what are you doing here?
At the moment, young lady, I'm covering both of you with a revolver. Please don't move.
So, you were in the conspiracy, Dr. Heinrich.
May I ask you, what conspiracy?
The whole ship's conspiracy to say Richard Brewster didn't exist.
My dear young lady, you can set your mind at rest. There never was any ship's conspiracy against you. The people you spoke to were perfectly honest.
Including Mr. Marshall, I suppose.
Yes, including Mr. Marshall.
Man, what is this all?
Stand back there.
I suppose he was telling the truth when he said nobody came up the gangplank before or after me.
I beg your pardon. That was not what he said. He said no passenger came up the gangplank at this time.
Well, what's the difference?
A great crime is arranged for tonight, young lady. No less a crime than murder.
Murder? Who's going to be murdered?
You are.
What?
That, I repeat, is a scheme. But there is no conspiracy and only one criminal.
Oh. And who is the criminal?
The criminal is the man standing beside you. Your so-called husband.
Ricky? Oh, you don't know what you're saying.
I think I do. Marshall, of course, did see someone walk up the gangplank, loitering behind you. But he never dreamt of associating the person in any way with you. He saw a ship's officer returning from shore leave in civilian clothes.
A ship's officer?
Yes. That man you call your husband, his name isn't Richard Brewster. His real name is Blaney. And he's the first officer of the Mauravania.
Are you trying to tell me
that the captain can identify him. He's actually British, though he can fake an American accent very well. He has already got a wife in England, and he's planning to join her with the $10,000 he got from you.
I don't believe it. I don't. Ricky, why don't you say something?
Oh, he planned it very cleverly, I must admit. He never let you know he was ship's officer, did he? He's been away for some time, naturally, so he persuaded you to marry him in a hurry.
Ricky, is this true?
He has the money, you see. All he did was hang a dummy number on the cabin door, remove it later, put on his uniform, and walk away with his own luggage.
But Captain Wainwright told us that the first officer had come aboard tonight with...
With a bad attack of flu, yes. Our friend couldn't be seen in public until after he disposed of you. The best thing was to convince everybody you were insane, as he did. Then, when you went overboard tonight...
They would all believe it was suicide.
Exactly. But I began to suspect this Brewster, because you quoted him as telling such an obvious lie. He said he had never traveled in the Mauravania, yet he could direct you all over the ship, and even knew where the purser's office was. So I went to his cabin, found it empty, searched, and found your $10,000. Put it down, you fool. Put it down.
Oh, it's overboard. You've shot him.
Your shots, my dear, never touched him.
Never touched him?
No. The weight of the iron carried him over backwards when he lifted it. It was the weight he was going to use to sink your body.
Ricky! The propellers! The ship's propellers!
Yes. They suck you under.
Oh, doctor. Doctor, I can't stand this.
It won't be easy, my dear. It won't be easy, I know, but... Believe me, this way is better.
And so closes Cabin B-13, starring Margot and Philip Dawn. Tonight's tale of suspense. With our two stars tonight were Dennis Hoy as Captain Wainwright and William Johnstone as Ricky Brewster. This is the man in black who conveys to you Columbia's invitation to spend this half hour in suspense with us again next week, same time, when our star will be one of the screen year's most sensational newcomers, Mr. Gene Kelly. Mr. Kelly will be supported by Hans Conried and William Johnstone. The producer and director of Suspense is William Spear, who with Lud Gluskin and Lucian Morrowick, conductor and composer, and John Dixon Carr, the author, collaborated on tonight's Suspense.
Suspense fans, please note that these programs will shortly move to different days of the week. Suspense will come to listeners in Eastern and Central time zones on Thursdays, beginning December the 2nd, and to Mountain and Pacific time zone listeners on Monday, beginning December the 6th. Remember, Thursday, beginning December the 2nd in Eastern and Central time zone, and Mondays, beginning December the 6th in the Pacific and Mountain time zones for Suspense. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
There are thousands of cases similar to that of the girl named Rose Puglisi. No single one of them, perhaps, is of earth-shaking significance. And yet, taken all together, they comprise an impressive body of evidence. Evidence that there is a whole world of human experience which science has not even begun to understand.
At 15, Rose Pugliese was a normal, attractive American girl. If she had one idiosyncrasy, it was what she called her intuition, about which she boasted frequently, much to the amusement of her family and friends. But after the night of February 1st, 1941, they ceased to be amused. About 11 o'clock that night, Rose's parents, returning from a neighborhood movie, found their daughter sitting in the living room, staring moodily out the window.
Why, Rose, darling, you're still up.
I don't feel like going to bed.
Worried about something, honey?
No, not exactly.
Then up you go.
Reluctantly, Rose climbed the stairs to her bedroom. 10 minutes later, her mother glanced up to find the girl standing by her chair.
Why, Rose, what's the matter?
I can't do it, Mother. I just can't go to bed in that room.
But why not?
It's just a feeling. I feel as if I were never going to sleep in that bed again.
Well, what do you want, dear?
Stay down here in the living room, in the big chair there. I'd rather stay awake all night than go into my room again.
And neither logic nor ridicule could persuade Rose Pugliese to change her mind. An hour later, her parents retired to their own rooms. And Rose, looking disconsolate and a little sheepish, curled up in the big chair. At 4 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Pugliese opened his eyes and stared into the darkness. Something had disturbed his sleep. A sound. An odor, strange and yet unpleasantly familiar. In an instant, he was sitting erect in his bed, tugging violently at his wife's arm.
Mother! Mother, wake up!
What's the matter, dear?
We've got to get out of here! There's a fire!
Throwing their robes around them, they yanked open the door and hurried out into the hall.
Father, look! Under that door! Smoke! Oh, the fire's in Rose's bedroom!
Before the night was over, the interior of the Pugliese home had been gutted, Rose's bedroom completely destroyed, and her bed, the bed which she had a feeling she would never sleep in again, was reduced to ashes. It was inevitable that the local newspaper should get wind of this strange affair. And when the reporter came to interview Rose Pugliese, he asked her, first of all, whether she did not think it was remarkable that her life should have been saved by a mysterious premonition.
Remarkable? No, I don't see anything very remarkable about it. You see, I've had hunches like that lots of times, and every one of them turned out to be true.
No, the story of Rose Pugliese is not a unique one. Thousands of other ordinary people have had similar hunches, similar premonitions. And as long as science rejects the idea of supernormal perception and scoffs at the gift of prophecy and yet provides us with no alternate explanation, just so long we must continue to label such stories incredible but true.
Cabin B-13. From his notebooks of the strange and sinister, Dr. Fabian brings you tonight's tale of The Sleep of Death.
A circular bedroom, high in a castle tower, hung with rare tapestries, filled with a haunting atmosphere of witchcraft and death. The young American, Ned Whiteford, knew that for 200 years, no person who had slept in that room had lived through the night. Whatever it was that killed, left no trace. Would you, like Whitefoot, have dared to rest your head there because you were in love?
From Cabin B-13, CBS brings you another great tale of mystery and murder, written by the world-famous best-selling mystery author John Dixon Carr, directed by John Deetz. Now, here's Mr. Carr's famous Dr. Fabian, ship surgeon and world traveler, to tell you tonight's tale, The Sleep of Death.
Ned Whitefoot crossed with us to France aboard the Mauravania back in 38. He was looking forward to his new position at the American Embassy. He was young, and even war jittery Paris was a magic land to him. It was on St. Catherine's Day that Ned, unknowingly, made a decision that brought him to the threshold of unspeakable terror and death. And he made it in the midst of the gayest celebration Paris knew, the president's costume ball at the opera. Look at Ned now, wearing the uniform of one of Lafayette's officers. Look closely at the dark-haired young girl in costume, sitting across from him at the little table, half-screened by the palms.
Ned, don't. Please, you mustn't.
Look here, Ileana. We've got to settle this thing. You've enjoyed being here tonight, haven't you?
Oh, Ned, I've loved it. After being hemmed in at my uncle's place in the country, oh, it's like heaven.
All right. When I take you back to the hotel tonight, I'm going to face this dragon uncle of yours.
No, no, you mustn't.
I'm going to say that you and I intend to get married, and that's that.
I can't marry you, Ned. I told you that.
But why not? Give me just one good reason.
Because I can't. My uncle would never allow it.
And that seems to you a good enough reason?
Yes.
This uncle of yours, what's his name?
Count Stephen Kohari.
He's a Hungarian, I think you said.
Yes, so am I. My mother was an American.
What's he like, actually?
Well, he's a little eccentric. He... Ned.
What is it?
There he is now.
Your uncle?
Yes, the elegant man in plain evening clothes with the Order of the Golden Fleece across his chest.
I see him. He looks as black as a thundercloud.
Oh, give me my mask, quick. Before he sees us.
No, Ileana.
Why not?
We'd better face this out now. Sit still.
Good evening, Ileana.
Good evening, Uncle Stephen. Uncle, may I present Ned Whitefoot?
How do you do, sir?
How do you do? Ileana, do you think that costume is quite the thing to wear in public?
Why not?
An older generation might call it immodest. It looks like...
Like what?
Nothing. You go and get your cloak or your domino, whatever you wore here.
Uncle, please.
Do as I say.
Don't make me go home so soon. It's hardly 11 o'clock.
I was not asking you to go home, my dear. I was merely asking you to put on a wrap.
Oh. All right, I'll get it. You stay and talk to Ned.
I shall be delighted.
Will you sit down, sir?
Thank you. You seem to have had quite a gathering at this table.
Yes, some friends of mine from the embassy there. Upstairs dancing now.
Glasses, glasses, and still more glasses. I was quite an adept once at musical glasses.
Yes?
Have you ever tried it, young man?
No.
You take a spoon, like this, and...
Forgive me, sir. There's something I'd like to ask you.
Yes, young man?
Exactly know how to say this, so I'd better say it in the shortest way. I want to marry your niece. Look out, sir. You've smashed one of the glasses.
Doubtless a few francs will pay for it. There are other things with a higher value, at least for me.
Well, maybe I ought to mention that I'm attached to the American Embassy here. That I have some money of my own and have to support Ileana well.
Indeed.
I only mention that to show, well, that Ileana will be well provided for. The ambassador will vouch for me if you'd like to ring him up.
I ought to mention... I have always kept Ileana carefully guarded from the world.
almost too carefully guarded, don't you think?
That, young man, depends on my reason.
I'm sorry again.
You have known Ileana how long?
A week.
A week. You would not lose a business partner in a week. Yet you want to marry Ileana a week after you meet her.
We know our own minds, sir.
And you know more than the wisest men of the world. However, as one whose dearest wishes Ileana's happiness...
I hope it is, Count Corey.
You doubt what I say?
Oh, no, sir. Go on.
Well, let me make you a counter-proposition. I own a chateau in Touraine, not far from Paris.
I know, Ileana told me.
And here is my suggestion. Why not come down and visit us for a week or two?
Well, that's very decent of you, sir.
Not at all. If at the end of that time you are not cured of this infatuation...
Well, it's not an infatuation. I swear it's not.
If at the end of that time you are not cured permanently of this feeling, you may take Ileana with my blessing. Is that fair?
It's more than fair, Count Corey. I don't know how to thank you.
Don't try. There is just one thing, however.
Yes, sir?
At the Chateau d'Azay, there's a certain bedroom. We call it the tapestry room.
Yes?
I assure you it will be very interesting to sleep in that room.
Why? Is it haunted or anything like that?
Not exactly haunted. And now, if you don't mind, I shall say good night. I think I can trust you to bring Ileana safely to the hotel.
Yes.
In the meantime, look there.
What is it now?
Those streams of our fellow guests pouring down the main staircase. Shapes of nightmare. Shapes of delirium. Insane, dead masks where only the eyes move. Mightn't you be terrified, perhaps, if you could look behind those masked gargoyle faces?
No, I don't think so. They're only ordinary people like ourselves.
That's, where you make your mistake. I shall expect you for the weekend. Good night.
Good night, sir.
Ned.
It's all right, Ileana. You can come out from behind the palm.
What was my uncle saying? I couldn't hear.
Ileana, it couldn't be better. He's a very decent old boy, actually. And he's invited me to the Chateau d'Azay.
Did he say anything about the tapestry room?
Yes, he asked me if I'd mind sleeping there.
And you said...
That I would, naturally.
You mustn't do it, Ned. I won't let you do it.
Why the devil not?
Because everybody who sleeps in that room dies.
Are you serious?
Ned, please don't do it.
Nonsense. A lot of superstitions about every old house.
This isn't a superstition, Ned. It happened once when I was a little girl. A man insisted on sleeping there. They found him dead in the morning.
So? How did he die?
They don't know. There wasn't a mark on his body. He wasn't shot or stabbed or strangled or poisoned or hurt in any way. He was just dead.
Two nights later, in the part of France once called La Touraine, the wind moans down the valley, and rain flickers across the apple trees, and thunder stirs in those haunted hills. They bring four comfort to a young man driven in an ancient carriage from the railway station along snake-like roads and leading to what destination? Ahead, a flash of lightning shows the gray walls and conical slate-roofed towers of a chateau set some distance back from the road. Light shines from its narrow windows, dimly seen through the rain.
Driver, coachman.
Yes, monsieur.
Is that the Chateau d'Azay up ahead?
Yes, monsieur. I will take you to the very door if...
If what? Why do you cross yourself?
If I am permitted.
What should stop you?
Only fear, monsieur. I am not much afraid.
What was that?
Only the dogs, monsieur. They keep many dogs. large dogs at the chateau, does he?
Those dogs dangerous? They have to fly at anybody who goes to the front door?
I cannot say, monsieur. But I should advise you to make haste.
Here's your money.
Oh, thank you. Good night, monsieur. And if one so humble as myself may be permitted a word of advice.
Yes?
Beware of the tapestry room.
Yes.
Monsieur is expected. Please to enter. Monsieur's hat and coat.
Thank you.
Ned.
Hello, Ileana.
Mon retour, ma petite. Come on.
You'd better not kiss me, Ned. Madame Frey says to look out for my uncle.
Mm.
She's our housekeeper.
Where is your uncle now?
In the drawing room. Come along.
Ileana, is anything wrong?
Everything's wrong. Two of my dogs were in horrible pain this afternoon. Dr. Solomon had to put them out with chloroform.
You don't think...
I hope nobody's practicing, that's all. Here we are.
Nice tiger skins on the floor. I say, who's that little old man with a gray beard sitting over by the fire?
That's Dr. Solomon.
That funny-looking eyes.
He watches and watches and watches. He's an old friend of the family. Come on, let's get this over with.
Ah, my young friend. Welcome to the Chateau d'Azay.
Thank you, Count Corey.
You must be very wet after your long drive. Go up to the fire and warm yourself.
Thank you.
Madame Play.
Yes, monsieur.
Please tell Antoine to take our guest's luggage up to the tapestry room.
The tapestry room, monsieur?
That is what I said, Madame Play.
Yes, monsieur.
An odd coincidence, Mr. Whitehall. Dr. Solomon and I were just discussing the fate of the last person who slept in the tapestry room.
This is not good, my friend. This is against my advice.
Here, Dr. Solomon croaking.
This is not good, I tell you. It is the wrong season of the moon.
Moon? But there's no moon tonight. It's raining cats and dogs.
Don't talk about dawn. Nevertheless, it is the wrong season of the moon. I say no more.
Cheerful man, that doctor.
Don't do it, Ned. I won't be responsible if they let you do it.
But look here, Count Corey. What did happen to the last fellow who slept in the tapestry room?
You must not call him a fellow, young man. He was a very saintly gentleman. The Bishop of Tours. That was some time ago. Ileana was only 15 years old. But surely she must remember it.
I remember it.
The church said our bishop has no use for superstitions. He insisted on sleeping there. I made him as comfortable as possible. He was found dead the next morning with a crucifix still in his hand.
Was it poison?
There was no poison, monsieur.
Here, Dr. Solomon.
It's true, Ned.
There were just two curious things in connection with the death, Mr. Whitefoot. On the mantelpiece was found burning a stick of incense. Ordinary incense, nothing wrong with it.
Yes, sir.
And under the dressing table, the police found an empty jar of ointment. Now come, use your detective wits. A dead man and some burning incense and an empty jar of ointment. What do you make of that?
I don't make anything of it. Is there any reason for this story of death?
Reason?
Any legend attached to the room or something like that?
Yes, there is.
Well, sir?
We are a very old family, my friend. Old and perhaps accursed. When certain of my ancestors moved from Hungary to France in the 17th century, they brought certain beliefs with them. The old religion.
The old religion?
Yes, the cult of Diana. The witch cult, if you prefer.
Now, look here, sir.
Must we talk about this?
Ah, you smile. When I say the word witch, Mr. Whitefoord, you think of some humorous picture on a Halloween card. It was very different in the Middle Ages, believe me. There were many to worship unashamed at the Grand Sabbath. To receive all favors from Satan, their master. To dance forever joyously in the red quadrilles of the netherworld. Some 200 years ago, an ancestress of mine, Catherine Corey, was tortured to death in the tapestry room for professing the old religion. Many persons have not thought it safe to sleep there since. Are you answered?
Come, sir, this is some kind of elaborate joke.
Joke? The Bishop of Tours did not find it a joke.
Not a mark on his body. I assure you, as a physician, not a mark on his body.
You hear, Dr. Solomon?
I hear him.
Understand me, my boy. There's no compulsion in this. If you had not the nerve to sleep in that room...
Who says I haven't got the nerve?
You're weakening. I think I can see it in your face.
Would you like to make a little bet on that?
What sort of bet?
If I spend the night in this famous room and come out of it alive...
Go on.
Will you give your consent to the marriage immediately? Tomorrow morning?
Why tomorrow morning?
Because I don't think the atmosphere of this place is good for Ileana. What do you say? Will you do it?
Very well, my boy. I accept the terms of your wager.
Don't do it, Ned. For the love of heaven, don't do it.
High up in the north tower of the Chateau d'Azay, under the conical slate roof, is the circular room hung with faded tapestries. These tapestries move slightly, with uneasy mimic life, to the clamor of the storm outside. Candles burn along the mantelpiece, and beside the great four-poster bed. The flames of these candles waver too, as the door opens.
This is the tapestry room, monsieur.
Thank you, Madame Flay.
That is the mantelpiece where the incense burned. That is the bed where Monseigneur the Bishop died.
Very inviting, isn't it?
Will there be anything else that monsieur requires? Some sandwiches? A decanter of whiskey?
No, thanks. I had a drink with Count Corey before I came upstairs.
Very well, monsieur. Monsieur's shaving water will be brought up in the morning. If he requires it. Good night.
Infernal old harpy. Trying to scare a fellow out of his wits just because... Well, I feel a good fire anyway. I didn't realize how cold it was. What's that?
It's I, Ileana. May I come in?
No, Ileana. I don't want you exposed to whatever it is.
Ned, listen. Are you going to bed or are you going to sit up all night?
I'm going to sit up all night, naturally.
Then let me sit up with you.
No.
Why not?
First, because it may be dangerous. Second, because I promised your uncle I'd go through this alone.
Oh, I wish you hadn't had that drink with him.
Couldn't have done anything to it. You poured it.
Yes, that's true, only...
It was only one of the dogs.
No. It sounded like somebody walking inside the wall of this room. Don't you hear it?
By George, it is somebody walking inside the wall. Get behind that tapestry, Ileana. Quick. Hurry.
All right.
Count Corey! Where did you come from?
Forgive me, my boy, for seeming to appear out of the wall and between the tapestries, like Mephisto appearing to Faust. This red dressing gown perhaps adds to the effect.
How did you get here? A passage between the walls?
Exactly. A little device of my ancestors for visiting this room when its occupant was so unmannerly as to bolt the door.
The door is not bolted. You could have walked straight in.
But I could not have done it unobserved.
No, maybe not.
Have you had any other visitors, my boy?
No.
You're sure of that?
Quite sure.
And since nobody saw me come here, I'll just sit down by the fire. Please sit opposite me.
Is this the showdown, sir?
I don't understand you.
There's got to be a showdown between us. Is that why you're here?
I am here, young man, to explain certain things to you. Now, would you have a cigarette?
I'm
not doped. That's what you're afraid of.
I'll have one. Yes.
Good. Light?
Thank you.
When I was discussing the witch cult a while ago, you did not appear to think I meant what I said.
You want a perfectly frank answer to that?
Yes.
I think you're mad enough to mean anything.
What you say, in a sense, is quite true. In an old and inbred family like ours, the mind can crack, and the fantasies of witchcraft become as real, more real, than the living world. Let me give you an example.
Go on.
The saucer on the table beside you is Ming porcelain. It was once owned by Catherine Corley, a martyr of the old religion. Yet you're using it as an ashtray.
I beg the witch lady's pardon. I'll blow off the ash.
A dangerous remark, sir. Don't you understand that to a sick brain which knows but can't help itself, you have profaned this room merely by entering it? Therefore, you deserve to die.
Like the Bishop of Tours?
Exactly.
You're not going to tell me the devil killed him.
The devil's agent may be flesh and blood.
Then it was murder.
Of course it was murder. Murder so cunningly contrived that no one ever saw through it.
Go on.
I asked you before to use your detective wits on this problem. Incense was burned in this room. Why?
Suppose you tell me.
Obviously, I think, to conceal something else which would be too easily noticed.
To conceal what?
The smell of chloroform.
Chloroform?
Yes. A drug not well understood by laymen. Dr. Solomon was using chloroform this afternoon to dispose of some dogs.
So I've heard.
Dr. Solomon is old and forgetful.
You mean chloroform could be stolen?
It could be, easily. Now suppose, just suppose, I take a pad saturated with chloroform. I place it over the mouth and nostrils of a man already sleeping, or drugged, so that he gets no other air.
Wait a minute. That won't do.
Why not?
Chloroform burns and blisters when it touches the skin. You'd leave marks.
Not at all, my friend. Not at all if I first covered the mouth and nostrils with some substance, like...
ointment.
Ah. You're waking up.
I...
Now observe what follows. In a few seconds, unconsciousness. In 2 minutes, 3 minutes...
Certain death. Yes.
But chloroform, it evaporates. Delay your post-mortem for 24 hours. A very easy matter in these country districts. And no trace remains in the blood. Murder without a mark, my friend. Murder without a mark.
There's just one thing you're forgetting, Count Corey.
What's that?
I'm not sleeping. And I'm not drugged.
Oh, yes. You are?
In the cigarette?
No. In the drink you had with me.
What was it?
Morphine. You've had enough to put 3 men to sleep. That's it. Try to get up.
I'll try. And I'll do it.
Okay. You've knocked over the fire island. You could have been in the fire yourself if I hadn't caught you.
Take your hands off me.
Just as you please.
If I could reach that bell, pull...
You can't. Better sit down again.
You murdering lunatic. So that's how you killed the Bishop of Tours. And that's how you're going to kill me.
I? You don't think I killed the Bishop of Tours?
Didn't you?
You young fool. I'm not trying to kill you. I'm trying to save you. Dr. Solomon!
Yes, sure, of course.
Come out from behind that secret door. Come out and be my witness.
Yes, sure. I shall always guard the family honor, even when I guess how men die.
This young man evidently thinks I've been talking about myself. Am I, in the popular parlance, mad?
Oh, heaven forbid, monsieur! I have never known a saner man.
Have you any notion, Mr. Whitehood, why I brought you to this house? You would not have believed me if I had merely told you. So I had to bring you here and show you.
Show me?
What? Come out from there, please. Come out!
Ileana!
Why have I kept Ileana so well guarded from the world? Why, the fancy dress ball, did I object to the costume of a medieval witch? Whose dogs were poisoned so that chloroform should be brought? Who poured you the drink drugged with morphine?
In the devil's name! What are you trying to tell me?
Ileana. She has been hopelessly insane for more than 10 years.
And so ends my story, The Sleep of Death, a tale which may give uneasy moments to those of you who may be inclined to fall in love at first sight. Next week I shall tell you a story that many of you have asked me to tell again. It's the adventure of an easygoing, straightforward New York detective who followed a beautiful murder suspect to Port Said, the crossroads of crime, and who learned that duels are still fought with swords as well as with 38s. And so, next week, when I tell you this tale I call The Dancer from Stamboul, will you join me, Dr. Fabian, here in my cabin B-13?
From Cabin B-13, CBS has brought you another strange and sinister tale of mystery and murder, written by the world-famous best-selling author John Dixon Carr and directed by John Deet. Arnold Moss is featured as Dr. Fabian, and in tonight's drama, Cliff Carpenter appeared as Ned Whiteford, Janice Gilbert played Ileana, and Peter Capel appeared as Count Corey. The music for Cabin B-13 is especially composed and conducted by Alfredo Antonini. Join us again next week, same time, same station, for Dr. Fabian's tale, The Dancer from Stamboul. Just for fun, make a New Year's resolution to keep on listening to CBS on Sunday nights next year. Otherwise, you'll miss all the fun Jack Benny brings for next Sunday, January 2nd. Marks the day Jack moves here to CBS with all his crew, Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, all the rest. From next Sunday on, the Jack Benny Show will come to you exclusively over these CBS stations. The time? 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
That's the Relic Radio Show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget RelicRadio.com. For all your old-time radio needs, we've got all kinds of old-time radio podcasts of different varieties. And if you're not into podcasting, you're probably not hearing this, but you can always listen to our shows right from the website. RelicRadio.com's got links to those. Our forum, our live stream, our listener community, everything Relic Radio can be found there. You can email me at relicradio@gmail.com. Thanks for joining me this Tuesday. I'll be back next Tuesday with another episode of the Relic Radio Show.